The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Harris Serrano, captain of the armed civilian yacht Sweet Delight, has successfully defended the agricultural world Xavier from an attack by raiders. Now, a fleet battle group, led by Commodore Deccan Garavay, has arrived to assist in the defense. But Harris has suspicions about the Commodore.
You think he's turned?
We have to stop them.
If you're wrong about any of it,
then I'm dead.
Ah, Captain. Or may I call you Harris? What was it you wanted to talk to me about?
Well, Commodore.
Attention, all personnel. This is Commander Harris Serrano, now acting captain of this vessel.
There's something jumping in.
Engage.
Meanwhile, on the planet Patchcock, Ronnie, George, and Rafaela are on a secret mission to investigate the murder of the daughter of a wealthy family.
So you think Otala knew something she wasn't supposed to know?
You need to mind your own business.
You killed Otala?
No, you don't.
Is he dead? What about the weapon?
Drop that weapon! Get on the floor! Move!
You won't believe this. They're under arrest for murder and attempted sexual assault.
Serrano Legacy, Book 3, Winning Colors, Part 2. From Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation. Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, Anne Flosnick, Dolores King Williams, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, James Lewis, Tom Simpson, Christopher Graybill, James Konacek, Dylan Lynch, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 14, Hell Rising. The knocking barely roused Aubrey Quayle from his meditations. The study of Plato in the original Greek required such concentration he almost entered an altered state, especially since his comprehension of the language was completely self-taught. To absorb the text, Quayle practiced a form of auto-hypnosis, regulating his breathing and employing a relaxation technique he had learned as a private in the Imperial Dragoons. Aubrey continued to stare at the open book, pendulous lips unconsciously forming the words imprinted on the page, translating them into English.
Oh, Solon, you Greeks are children. There have been and will be many destructions of mankind, of which the greatest are by fire and water.
Quayle couldn't argue with that bit of precognition, even if he had cared to do so. Placing a blunt index finger on the sentence, he lifted his head.
Come!
The door opened and Corporal Jeffries stepped in, ducking his head both in deference and to keep his beret from being scraped off by the low frame. He snapped off a brisk salute.
It's time, Captain.
The corporal wore the dark red uniform of the Dragoons, consisting of a hip-length leather jacket and beret canted at an angle on his close-cropped blonde hair. The beret bore an insignia patch displaying a coiled bat-winged serpent, blood red, outlined against a black background. Mirrored sunglasses concealed his eyes. A Beretta M92 auto pistol hung in shoulder leather. The right side of his face bore a geometric design, a black rectangle superimposed over a small chevron.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffries.
Quayle poked around among the rolled charts and stacked volumes cluttering his desk and found a silver bookmark. Carefully, he closed the leather-bound book and levered himself upright by the arms of his chair. Captain Aubrey Quayle towered a full head above the corporal. He wore a nearly identical uniform, except for shiny metal epaulets on the shoulders of the jacket. His massive belly strained the seams. He had always been a quartermaster's nightmare, even in his teens when the Imperium Britannia had first conscripted him into the Dragoons. His huge head, the size and shape of a pumpkin, rose between the broad yoke of his shoulders. It was completely hairless, both eyebrows and scalp a naked grotesquerie of dead white flesh and scar tracings. His left eye gleamed like a ruby, but his right was black, the iris a milky blue. A wheeled, ridged mass of scar tissue surrounded the socket and creased across his heavy jowl, bisecting the two vertical bars tattooed into the flesh. A pale slab of a hand removed his beret from a hook on the wall, and he took some time placing it just so on his bald pate. Jeffries respectfully stood aside in a parade rest posture as Quayle swiftly inspected his reflection in a small mirror. Then he turned to squeeze his 400-pound, 6-foot-7 bulk through the doorway. Followed by Jeffries, he lumbered down the passageway that connected the port and starboard quarters. At the stairwell, Quayle went down to where they ended at an open door. He pushed through it to the second-tier open-air deck of the North Star 40 drilling platform. He paused for a moment to inhale the sharp smell of the Atlantic Ocean, relishing the briny tang. Despite the sun blazing in the blue expanse of the sky, the temperature was still unseasonably cool. He didn't shiver from the chill wind gusting over the white-capped expanse of the sea, though he noticed Jeffries hunching his shoulders against its bite. Due to his mutagenically altered metabolism, he and his fellow dragoons were very sensitive to the cold. Then again, they didn't have Quayle's layers of fat to act as insulation. He strode across the deck, glancing up at the flock of gulls wheeling overhead, and wondered how the carrion feeders knew in advance they would soon feast. Seen from a distance, North Star 40 rose from the ocean surface like an iceberg made of steel. The platform was 280 feet long and 212 feet wide, with three decks built around the skeletal drilling derrick, the top of which climbed nearly 90 feet into the cloudless sky. The platform had been built as a floater, a dynamically positioned semi-submersible rig. At the base of each massive leg roared 2,000 horsepower thrusters that maintained the platform's position. Tethered by heavy rope hawsers between the pair of starboard legs was the Cromwell, a sleek, sharp-prowed vessel painted a flat, sinister black. Its streamlined, sharply faceted contours made it look like a gigantic knife blade. Placed amidships, the snouts of three 40-millimeter Bofors cannons jutted out from behind metal deck shielding. The Limbo anti-submarine system, a quartet of 3-foot-long hollow pipes angled upward at 45-degree angles, was affixed near the bow. A pair of tripod-mounted L7A1 heavy-caliber machine guns was bolted to the roof of the elevated bridge housing. The Cromwell was a corvette, its regenerative gas turbine engines capable of driving it at 50 knots maximum speed on smooth seas. She was a stealth ship, on the cutting edge of radar-baffling technology 200 years ago. But she was more than just a vessel to Quayle. All his hopes and dreams were packaged in her 100-yard length. He was quarterdeck bred to the bone, something his officers didn't understand but respected nevertheless. At least, all but one of them did. Lieutenant Richardson was already in place by the guardrail, his ankles, wrists, and arms tightly bound by lengths of hemp. A number of fist-sized lead balls were attached to the ropes. He stood directly beneath a thick I-beam. Suspended from the beam was a squat, compact electric hoist. A length of chain, tipped with a clip hook, dangled from a movable boom arm at the end of the hoist. Two dragoons held Richardson upright beneath the chain. The other 22 stood at stiff attention. A small figure wearing a hooded warm-up suit stood several feet away. Although Richardson still wore his uniform, his beret and sunglasses were missing, and he squinted against the bright sunlight. His deeply socketed eyes were large and almond-shaped, with black vertical slits centered in golden irises. He had no eyebrows, only a faint interlocking pattern of scales that met at the bridge of his nose. He glared at Quail.
You fat bastard!
The dragoon standing by Richardson lashed out with his fist. Richardson reeled, spitting blood on the rust-streaked deck. With dispassionate eyes, Quail regarded the man.
Let us proceed.
Don't I even get a bloody blindfold? Not even any last words.
You said all you were going to say at your trial, Mr. Richardson. The testimony was damning.
The man jerked his head violently toward the hooded figure.
Her testimony? She's a mutie and Irish to boot. Why take her word for anything?
The figure moved forward with lithe, graceful steps, reaching up to tug down the hood, revealing a fair-skinned, heart-shaped face with a snub nose and full lips. She was beautiful, despite her grave expression. Her eyes were blue-white, with no irises or pupils visible. Hair the color of steel was intricately woven into round braids on either side of her head. Even the shapeless warm-up suit she wore did not completely conceal the voluptuous figure swelling underneath.
You know who I am and what my abilities are. I am never wrong.
Richardson tried to sneer, but he couldn't quite bring it off due to his split lips.
If Lord Strongbow hadn't heeded your counsel, he would still be among us. I was on the Cromwell when the Selkies attacked Morrigan. I saw you pulled overboard. Yet rather than be drowned or torn to pieces like so many of our brothers, a fortnight ago you returned to New London, safe and unhurt. How did you manage that, you mutie whore?
Morrigan's face remained a blank, serene mask during the man's tirade.
I explained all that to Captain Quail's satisfaction. I do not justify myself to a thief.
Richardson strained against both his bonds and the hands of the dragoons holding him upright.
A thief? And what is Quail here but a thief? He stole Strongbow's position and he wasn't even a member of the elite like me. Captain Evil Eye!
Quail took one step forward, his massive hand darting out and closing around the lower half of Richardson's face and began to squeeze.
You've had your say, Mr. Richardson. Morrigan saw the treason in your corrupt little mind, an ambition to incite the crew to mutiny and take command of this mission.
As he spoke, his white-skinned hand tightened around Richardson's face, his spatulate thumb digging into the soft flesh beneath the man's right ear. Richardson's eyes bugged out.
You also stole, sir. I cannot and will not abide a thief. There can be only one penalty.
Quail released the lieutenant, shoving him away at the same time. The dragoons staggered as they tried to keep Richardson erect. Liquid scarlet shone bright and stark on the palm of Quail's hand.
Proceed!
Jeffries maneuvered the boom arm around on its swivel mount and pulled down the chain. One of the dragoons attached the hook to the ropes encircling Richardson's ankles, and the other stepped away from him. The man tried to maintain his balance, wobbling this way and that as the electric winch engaged. The chain snapped taut, yanking Richardson's feet out from under him. He crashed down on the deck plates. His legs stretched straight up as the chain drew him upward, raising him clear off the deck. Jeffrey swung the boom around so it overhung the ocean. Squirming, Richardson hung upside down, 50 feet above the surface of the sea, buffeted by the wind. Quail turned to one of his men.
The cutlass, Mr. Barrett!
Ceremoniously, Barrett lifted a steel scabbard held reverently in both hands. A small brass plate reading 1804 in swirling cursive script was affixed at the midway point of the sheath. Fitting his right hand into the intricately molded brass basket knuckle guard, Quail drew the cutlass with a flourish. Longer than the traditional naval swords, it was a weapon of exquisite craftsmanship. The 4-foot-long, mirror-bright blade reflected the sun, highlights chasing each other up and down its double-edged length. He hefted it for a moment, admiring its perfect balance. No matter how many times he held the ceremonial cutlass, he always felt a bit like King Arthur drawing Excalibur from the stone. Quail marched over to the rail and gazed steadily into Richardson's blood-flushed face.
You have been adjudged guilty in accordance with maritime and military law. I give you one last chance to repent of your crime before the sentence is carried out.
You and every man, Jack, who follows you are the ones who should repent. You're traitors to the Imperium. You've turned your back on it, and with my last breath, I curse all of you.
Quail swung the cutlass in a flat half arc. The sun glinted blindingly from the blade moments before it cleaved Richardson's head from his shoulders. It plummeted straight down into the ocean, followed by a vermilion rain. A gust of wind sprayed droplets in an artless pattern across Quail's face. The gulls dove toward the head, bobbing among the whitecaps. Quail turned away from the rail. Presenting the cutlass to Barrett, hilt first.
Clean it thoroughly.
Aye, aye, sir.
Jeffries, send Mr. Richardson to the locker.
Aye, Captain.
Jeffries stepped to the rail, leaned over, and worked out the hook from between the rope strands. The man's headless body plunged down, entering the water with scarcely a splash. The lead weights almost immediately dragged it beneath the waves, leaving only a red stain to spread across the surface. Not wiping the speckles of blood from his face, Quail silently surveyed the assembled dragoons. None of their faces registered any emotion.
I regret what had to be done, but if we are to rescue the Imperium from chaos, discipline must be uppermost in all of our minds. I will not make allowances for violations of the law, no matter how trivial they might seem. Am I understood?
Understood, sir!
Dismiss the men, Mr. Jeffries. Miss Morgan, come with me.
He lumbered across the deck, carefully avoiding places where the welds had sprung. Morrigan followed him along the passageway, up the stairs, and back into the day office. He closed and locked the door, then gazed levelly at the woman with his flesh-bagged right eye.
I can ill afford to lose men. Richardson was well-liked, and I found him a decent bloke myself.
Sometimes that kind is the most treacherous. The poison in the pudding, the knife in the hand patting you on the back.
Quail took a handkerchief from a pocket and dabbed at the damp blood on his cheek.
Ah, you're positive he was the thief?
I thought you had faith in my abilities.
She unzipped the front of her warm-up suit. A silver chain hung from the delicate column of her throat to her waist, and from it dangled a small charm, a talisman fashioned in the shape of three circle-topped triangles, an isosceles bracketing a pair of two scalenes. Quail nodded toward the chain around her neck.
Lord Strongbow trusted them, but only because he wasn't aware of your true allegiance. You've admitted to me you were a spy dispatched by the Priory of Eowyn. You took a very big risk in doing that.
Not at all. You never shared Strongbow's vengeful agenda against Ireland.
With a mocking smile, she tapped her forehead with a finger.
You continue to underestimate the true depth of my gifts. I knew you were a pragmatist upon our first meeting, and also, I felt your raging resentment against Strongbow for refusing to recognize your own gifts. He was a mad fool, blinded by ambition and hatred.
But as Richardson pointed out, he is gone, and yet here you are.
Strongbow ignored the counsel I provided. However, if my word isn't sufficient to damn Richardson as a traitor, I found this in his quarters. So not only was he snooping through your charts, he was robbing me.
She slid a hand into a pocket of her suit. Between thumb and forefinger, she held a small, perfect sphere. Though he had seen it before, Quail could not help but stare at it. Appearing no more substantial than a translucent soap bubble, the little ball looked as if it were made of rolled moonbeams. Its surface was perfectly smooth, showing no signs of pitting or even the most minuscule of casting seams.
The bead of Orichalcum. He didn't know what it was, of course, but he knew it was important to me, and that's why he took it. At least he didn't find the diskette.
Important to us. That's the real reason you wanted him dead, isn't it?
He gestured toward the litter of books and maps on his desk.
Not whether he went through this material.
Richardson suspected I was running a game on you, persuading you to undertake a mad quest so you would turn your back on Britain and allow the invaders to gain a secure foothold. And the same notion has occurred to you more than once.
Several times. My country is in a state of anarchy, and New London itself is under siege by your people. And here I sit with the Imperium's elite out in the North Sea. I don't blame the crew for being suspicious, not only of you, but of me.
The woman's lips twitched in a smile.
Catch.
She tossed the little orb to Quail, who snatched it one-handed out of the air, his flipper-like paw closing around it completely. He hefted it, his good eye narrowing to a slit.
Heavy. Deceptively heavy.
Does it feel like metal, Captain? Like any kind of ore you're familiar with?
Quail opened his hand, caressing the sphere with his thumb.
It does not. It feels almost...
organic?
Yes, organic. Like something alive.
She nodded toward the unshuttered window through which sunlight shafted.
Expose it to the sun, Captain.
Quail eyed her quizzically, then did as she suggested, holding his hand in the sunbeam, the small sphere nestled in the hollow of his palm. Absently, he noted how the surface of the orb did not glint in the light. After a few seconds, he frowned at her.
Now what?
Wait.
Wait for how...
A searing heat exploded in Quail's hand, scorching its way up his forearm. He jerked, flinging the little ball away from him. It struck the floor and rolled a few feet. Blinking back the tears of pain, he saw how a faint shimmer surrounded the orb, like the haze produced by heat waves. As the orb rolled, it left a thin black soot streak on the floor, wisps of smoke rising in its wake. Glancing down at his hand, he grimaced at the blister forming on the palm, an angry red welt bright against the pale flesh.
You Celtic bitch! So the myths are true, then. The Orichalcum is the firestone of legend.
Aye. A vast source of energy. Imagine what you can do with a shipload of it. That's worth a few lives, isn't it?
Quail tried to keep a smile from crossing his face.
Finding that shipload is the trick, isn't it?
It isn't a trick, Captain. It's an undertaking.
Quail stepped toward the bead of Orichalcum on the floor, but he didn't bend down to touch it or even nudge it with his foot. It no longer shimmered.
Everything turns out to be a trick in the end, Miss Morrigan.
Yes, as the citizens of Atlantis found out to their sorrow.
Just a wreck, right? In fucking frozen wasteland. Who the hell goes to Antarctica?
Grant glanced back through the wind-whipped snow to be sure Kane, Bridget, and Kata were still behind him. Kata and Bridget fought the snow. Kane plowed through it, watching their backs. The gateway chamber into which the four of them had materialized hadn't conformed to the standard specs that Grant, Bridget, and Kane had come to expect. It was very small, the walls not made of tinted armorglass shielding, but rather of plates of sheet metal lined with lead foil. The door of the chamber was different, too, with a transparent panel set in its top half and a central wheel to open and seal it. Once leaving the chamber, they saw that it was not placed on an elevated platform, and it opened directly into a small control center, barely 10 feet across. There was no adjacent recovery anteroom beyond. A single, simplified master control console ran the length of one wall, and they recognized a few of the basic command panels from the Cerberus installation. Many of the indicator lights were dark. They realized the little room was not part of a redoubt. It was the entire structure, a Quonset hut that was little more than a hutch standing between two bastions of rock. They were a little surprised and perplexed, but they didn't expend too much time trying to reason it out. Using the map provided by the Cerberus database, the four people had pushed out of the hut and onto the vast ice fields, trudging through the high snowdrifts and battered by the keening wind. It hadn't been dangerously cold at first, but the wind kept rising. All they saw through the veils of snow was a range of low mountains, rugged and bleak in the far distance. Grant shook his head and turned forward once more.
We'd better be going the right fucking way.
The formerly frozen solid ground beneath Grant's boots abruptly collapsed. He fanned his arms as he plummeted downward, blinded by the mini avalanche surrounding his body. Turning in the air, he tried to grab the ice-coated walls of the crevasse. His gloved fingers failed to secure a hold. He hit the bottom flat-footed, the twin impacts jacking both knees up into his lower belly. Falling over onto his left side, Grant tried to drag the painfully cold air into his emptied lungs. Snow covered the lenses of his goggles, so he saw nothing but gray-white.
Grant! Grant!
Yeah!
Grant forced himself to his elbows as he tried to get his air back. The sub-zero air abraded the moist tissues of his sinuses and throat. He gestured up and behind him, not sure if Kane, Bridget Baptiste, and Kata could see him in the gloom at the bottom of the hole. He realized he had strolled over a crevasse bridged only by snow and hoarfrost, and he cursed himself silently for not allowing Kane to take the point as he usually did. Clearing his goggles with a swipe of a mittened hand, Grant craned his neck up and around and saw the heads and shoulders of his companions outlined against the blue sky. At least he assumed they were his companions. It was hard to tell since they wore woolen, face-concealing balaclavas, goggles, and hooded thermal suits as he did. He gauged the distance to them at a little less than 20 feet.
I think I found the front door.
Good. Guess you've earned your bread for the week.
Kane's booted foot shifted at the top, sending snow and pebbles showering down. Grant sputtered, averting his face.
Knock it off! You trying to bury me alive?
If that happens, at least you'd keep for a long time in this place.
Heaving himself to his feet, Grant silently endured the twinge from his right leg. He brushed away crusts of snow that clung to his one-piece coverall. Despite the garment's thick, quilted padding and battery-powered heat filaments in the lining, the sub-zero cold still penetrated. Grant swiftly examined his surroundings. He kicked at the snow underfoot and uncovered a patch of steel plate.
This is definitely the place.
Grant surveyed the crevasse walls and saw, half embedded in the ice, horizontal strips of dark metal rising toward the opening. Moving closer, he saw the rungs of a steel ladder.
What have you found?
A ladder. Wish I'd known.
Our intel stated the installation was underground.
Yes, thank you, Bridget.
Removing a small pickaxe from his backpack, Grant began chipping away at two centuries of Antarctic ice from the rungs, clearing just enough to provide toe and finger holds. He climbed up as he worked. After he hacked a narrow gouge between all the rungs and the wall to which they were bolted, he climbed back down. Bridget, Kata, and Kane descended.
A little warmer down here.
Bridget spared Kata a sympathetic glance. He was still shaken by his recent trip through a Mattrans unit. Kata generally was quick-witted and fairly phlegmatic, but it was apparent he was scared half to death. A trip through the gateway was unsettling to the mind, to the nerves, and to the soul itself. By Kata's view, less than an hour ago, he had been in the Cerberus Redoubt in Montana. Now he was inside the ass of the Earth itself, freezing and terrified, and no doubt cursing himself for ever volunteering to be part of the jump team.
It just feels that way because we're out of the wind. It's still 70 below.
Lifting his goggles, Kane winced as the air stabbed his gray-blue eyes.
The sector has got to be here somewhere.
From a zippered pocket in his coverall, he removed a Nighthawk microlight and clicked it on. He cast around the amber-hued 5,000 candle-power mini-beam, the halo of illumination sliding over the walls. He swept it back and forth. For an instant, something very small and a very dim green winked beneath the sheathing of ice.
There.
Taking the pickaxe from Grant, Bridget stepped to where Kane held the Nighthawk's beam steady. Carefully, she tapped and scraped away the frost, revealing a liquid crystal display panel glowing green above a keypad.
Here we are.
Why would the gateway be placed above the actual entrance to the installation?
Well, if this was indeed a bioengineering facility, as Lakesh suspects, separating the means into and out of it is a sound security precaution. It prevents people from jumping directly into a potential biohazard or jumping out carrying contagions.
Yeah, we don't know what kind of installation this really is. It's not part of the official Cerberus Mattrans network, so that means it's not a totality concept installation. And that gateway unit looked like a prototype model.
Whatever this place is, it has the same computerized lock as every other redoubt linked to the totality concept. Let's see what happens.
She punched in the access code on the keypad. The numbers 352 glowed in the LCD window. Kane and Grant tensed, making sure there was enough leeway between their right sleeves and heavy gloves to allow their sin-eaters to jump into their hands if necessary. They waited for what seemed like a very long time. Nothing happened. Grant stamped his feet impatiently as the cold penetrated his fleece-lined boots and three layers of socks. Kata watched, wide-eyed, as he hugged himself against the biting cold.
What's going on?
Damn little, apparently. All the works are probably frozen solid, but nobody's set foot in here since 2001 or before, so the Barons couldn't be using it.
The four people tensed, alert and watchful. Long disused gears, pulleys, and hydraulics slowly moved. A huge oval of ice began to shake loose from the crevasse wall, quivering and acquiring a network of cracks that lengthened and widened. The team recoiled as splinters of ice and clots of snow showered them. The thick metal disc swung ponderously out like the door of a bank vault. A surge of wonderfully warm air belled out through the round opening, forming a cloud of mist as it met the frigid atmosphere of the crevasse. Through the fog, they saw glowing lights as overhead neon tubes flickered. The room beyond was small, more like a foyer than a chamber, but it had a high, metal-ribbed ceiling. A vid spy eye swiveled toward them, a power indicator light beneath the lenses shining steadily. Kata thrust his head forward cautiously and sniffed.
Smells sort of musty and stale.
Which is par for the course. I think Kane is right.
The Barons aren't using this place as a substitute for the Dulce facility. Nobody has been here for a long, long time.
They weren't surprised by the functioning lights or the vid camera. All totality concept and continuity of government redoubts had been built with their own nuke generators, and most of them continued to provide power centuries after their designers had crumbled to dust. Kane stepped through the open door and into the foyer. The room narrowed down to another heavy metal door, this one with a wheel lock centered in its dark mass. It was covered by a thin patina of frost.
Downright balmy in here. Must be at least 10 above.
He stripped off the goggles and balaclava, running a hand through his tousled hair. It was dark, a shade between black and chestnut, but showed sun-touched highlights. An inch over 6 feet, Kane's lean, flat-muscled body was completely concealed beneath a thermal suit, but it was apparent most of his muscle mass was contained in his upper body, lending his physique a marked resemblance to a wolf. His high-planed face held a watchful expression, as did his narrowed gray-blue eyes. A thin hairline scar cut across his left cheek. Bridget removed her own mask, shaking loose an unruly mane of long red-gold hair, tossing it back over her shoulders. Despite the unflattering coverall garment, a discerning eye could see she held a woman's willowy shape on long, athletic legs. Her hair framed a smoothly sculpted face with a rosy complexion dusted lightly with freckles across her nose and cheeks. There was a softness in her features that bespoke a deep wellspring of compassion, yet a hint of iron resolve was there, too. Even in the dim light, the color of emeralds glittered in her big, feline-slanted eyes. As they joined Bridget and Kane, Grant and Kata peeled up their balaclavas. Grant stood 6'4", exceptionally broad across the shoulders and thick through the chest. His black hair was cut close to the scalp and peppered with a sprinkling of gray at his temples. But the down-sweeping mustache showed jet black against his coffee-brown skin. His heavy-jawed face was set in a scowl. Kata was the shortest of the men, but built along stocky lines. His curly, dark brown hair and equally brown eyes gave him a boyish appearance. A flat case containing first aid items and survival rations hung from his shoulder by a strap.
We're going to go in there?
That's why we're here.
Oh, yeah, but you said nobody's been in here for a long time.
That's probably true, but it might not be true in a few weeks, a few days, or even a few hours. We have to learn if there's an installation the Barons can press into service as a bioengineering facility other than the one in Dulce. It would be naive to assume that there aren't more installations like that one to use as a contingency. At least we know the Ant Hill Complex in South Dakota won't serve that purpose.
Kane stepped over to the door, putting both hands on the wheel. Even through his gloves and mittens, he could feel the frigid metal. He turned it slowly and carefully.
Well, this hasn't moved in years, probably.
Putting his shoulder against it, Kane pushed the door open slowly, a few inches at a time. Peering around the edge, Kane and the others saw only a dimly lit passageway and the swastika.
Oh, that's just great.
The large banner was stretched taut within a narrow metal framework, affixed to the 15-foot-high ceiling by wires and eye bolts. Blood red, with a white disc in the center, the black symbol within it touched unpleasant chords of recognition within Kane, Grant, and Bridget. All sharp corners and angles, the swastika seemed to float several inches above the encircling white disc. Rust-red stains were barely discernible within the circle.
The Barons never used this place.
No. Something a lot worse did.
Kata's eyes flickered quizzically from the banner to the faces of his companions.
Oh, what's worse than the Barons?
Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei.
The what?
The Nazi Party. Sieg Heil.
You don't think this was a Nazi stronghold, do you?
At one time, probably. It's pretty much a historical given that the last battalion of high-ranking Nazi officers and scientists escaped to Antarctica in submarines during the last days of the war. It's apparent that once the Allies absorbed the totality concept researchers and personnel, they absorbed this base, too.
So this is a concept-related redoubt, after all.
If it was, it was an ancillary one, not the seat of any major division or subdivision. But somebody supplied them with the MATTRANS unit.
Let's check this out.
They moved down the corridor. It was about 10 feet wide, and concealed strip lighting flickered, casting gray, strobing shadows ahead of them. The temperature climbed the farther they walked. The walls and floor were not composed of softly gleaming vanadium alloy, as in most redoubts. They were constructed of dark, riveted metal that showed streaks of oxidation.
Obviously, this place predates the continuity of government installation building program. If this was a Nazi bolt hole or an installation set up for them, they're long dead.
The corridor opened up into a huge room that made them all stop dead in surprise. They found themselves in a huge office suite, furnished with 50 desks, stenography machines, metal file cabinets, and typewriters. Tacked onto bulletin boards were dozens of memos, all of them in German, and bearing either the swastika or a small symbol resembling two lightning bolts. At the far end of the room was a glassed-in row of cubicles. In the cubicles, they saw a number of computer terminals resting on desks, but none of them were even as recent as the old remanufactured DDC models in use at Cobaltville. A box-shaped mainframe system spanned one wall. Behind the glass doors, big reels of tape were attached to spindles. Clunky was the word that came to Kane's mind when he looked at it. Bridget eyed the mainframe.
That looks like a version of the ENIAC model.
What's that?
One of the first functional computers. It had about 18,000 vacuum tubes, and when operating properly, it could make 5,000 calculations per second. Trouble was, because of all its parts, it rarely functioned at all, much less properly.
This place was cutting edge, around 1960.
However, the place was as neat and tidy as if the people who worked there had simply gotten up to take a coffee break and would return in a few minutes. Items of a personal nature were scattered around the desks, framed black and white photographs of children wearing the neckerchief and shorts ensemble of the Hitler Youth, and Me Too pictures, people wearing white lab coats, shaking hands with men in uniform. Bridget recognized a few of the uniformed men.
Himmler, Goering? That one looks a lot like Mengele. A real gallery of human monsters.
Kane picked up and examined a small oil print that depicted Adolf Hitler on horseback, wearing medieval knight's armor and waving a Nazi flag. Grant, Kane, and Bridget dropped flat to the floor. Kata continued to stand, blinking around in bafflement.
Get down, asshole!
Oh my God! Someone's shooting at us!
He dropped to the floor behind the cover of a desk.
What's with you? You figure since the first shot missed, it's only polite to give the blasterman a second chance to plug you?
Oh, sorry. I've never been under fire before.
When you go out on these field trips with us, you get used to it.
The Sin Eater sprang into Kane and Grant's waiting hands. From a zippered pocket of her thermal suit, Bridget drew an Ivor Johnson autoblaster. Kata pulled an H&K VP-70 from a pocket of his own suit.
Who the hell is shooting at us?
A squatter, maybe.
More than once, they had come across redoubts that played host to the interlopers, but Kane doubted his own words. Even before the nuke cost, Antarctica was the most desolate, uninhabited region on the face of the planet. It seemed very unlikely wanderers or looters had stumbled across this installation.
Where is this? Identifizieren Sie sich!
He wants to know who we are.
Do you speak German?
Well, I've read the German to English dictionary in the database. I've never had the opportunity to speak it, but I can understand it.
Try.
Wir sind von dem, was früher als Amerika.
Americans? You come from where? Dulce? The anthill? You have come from me?
Who are you?
Skorzeny. Standartenführer Skorzeny of the Luftwaffe. You come from me, yeah?
Skorzeny. Otto Skorzeny?
You take me back?
He sounds disoriented.
Fused out, more like it.
We're going to stand up. We mean you no harm. Do you understand?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I understand.
Very slowly, fisting her Ivor Johnson but keeping it out of sight, Bridget half-inched her way up behind the desk. When she reached eye level with its surface, she paused.
Show yourself, bitte.
A figure stepped around a partition. A white beard spilled nearly to his stomach, covering the front of his black tunic like a fall of snow. His hair was equally white and very long, nearly the length of Bridget's. His face was deeply seamed and lined with a map of tiny furrows and blue veins. His white complexion was a deep, almost translucent pallor that came from not being exposed to the sun for a very long time. His eyes glittered a hot, furious cobalt blue. They were intensely penetrating eyes, intelligent eyes, all-seeing eyes, the eyes of a visionary or a madman. He wore the black tunic, jodhpurs, and knee boots Bridget recognized as belonging to the Schutzstaffel, the SS, the dreaded order of black knights who pledged their loyalty to Hitler, not to Germany. It was covered in gaudy emblems, including the twin lightning strokes and silver skull and crossbones from another day and era. She noticed the cuffs of the tunic were frayed and the boot leather cracked. The Sam Brown belt, crossing his chest and girding his lean waist, showed greenish spots of mildew. Loose threads dangled from the shoulder seams. What captured her attention the most was the black Luger gripped in his right hand. It trembled ever so slightly, but she doubted it was due to fear or cold.
Skorzeny, there are four of us. We're armed too, but we have no intention of harming you. We'll all stand up, understand?
Yeah.
First, lower your blaster, your weapon.
The man glanced at the Luger in his fist with mild surprise, as if he had forgotten it was there. His arm dropped to his side, the barrel pointing toward the floor. His hand trembled even more, as if he were suffering from a nervous disorder. Bridget rose to her full height, putting a friendly, inoffensive smile on her face. Skorzeny didn't return it, although it was hard to tell because of the whiskers draping the lower portion of his face. He tensed when, one by one, Kane, Kata, and Grant climbed to their feet. His eyes narrowed when he caught sight of Grant.
Who sent you?
You don't seem particularly interested in who we are.
That is unimportant. Depending upon who sent you, that will tell me all I need to know about you.
Kata hung back as his three companions approached the black-clad man. They moved cautiously, instinctively spreading out across the room as if to offer more difficult targets in case Skorzeny didn't like the answer to his question and started shooting again. The man's eyes flicked apprehensively from one to the other, but he didn't raise his Luger.
Where are you from? To what unit are you attached?
Montana. Redoubt Bravo. Is that of any use to you?
Nein. I've never heard of it.
There's no reason why you should.
How long have you been here?
Skorzeny peered at Bridget curiously.
You display many fine Aryan qualities, though you are not the ideal. Nevertheless, you are very attractive. You must take pride in your offspring.
His eyes darted toward Kane.
You must be the father. You are closer to a true Teutonic knight. Decision, authority, ruthlessness. I see those traits in your face. I trust you conceived your children in an SS cemetery.
What? A what cemetery?
Skorzeny's gaze moved on to Grant, disdain glittering in his eyes.
I had thought your kind would have been cleansed from the earth by now. However, I suppose there is always a need for servants, even if they are the Schwarze.
The Schwarze?
A racial epithet, forget it.
What's it mean?
What is the English term? Nigger?
Grant lashed out with a big open hand at Skorzeny's face. In a blur of motion, the bearded man hammered him between the eyes with the butt of his Luger. The blow came so swiftly, Grant didn't even see it. He sat down heavily, eyelids fluttering.
How dare you! I'll have you castrated with piano wire!
Son of a bitch!
Kane lunged, clubbing at the man with the barrel of his sin-eater.
Skorzeny ducked wildly aside and brought his Luger to bear. Bridget chopped at his hand with her Ivor Johnson.
Stop this!
She knocked the Luger aside, but not from Skorzeny's grasp. He pivoted on a heel and kicked out with a jackbooted foot. The toe took Kane in the groin. Grappling with Bridget, Skorzeny closed his left hand on the loose material at the front of her thermal suit and shoved her backward. She stumbled over Grant's legs and fell heavily against Kane, who was trying to straighten up. A bullet passed so close to Kane it fanned cool air on his cheek. The glass wall of a cubicle shattered. A bulletin board split as two rounds clouded it. Kane and Bridget joined Grant on the floor. Twisting around, Kane saw Kata trying to draw a bead on Skorzeny, his H&K held in a two-fisted grip. The black-clad Nazi backpedaled with astonishing speed and agility, the Luger in his hand spitting flame. Kata's blaster bucked as he returned the fire. Bridget, Grant, and Kane hunkered down beneath the double fusillade, praying they wouldn't be caught in the crossfire. Skorzeny danced and dodged among the desks. None of Kata's rounds came near him. Flat planes of cordite smoke hung in the air like streamers of dingy chiffon. Kata ran to the three people on the floor.
I don't think I hit him, but I chased him off.
Grant heaved himself to his feet, hand on his forehead.
You stoop, trigger-happy bastard. You came closer to hitting us than him.
Grant and Bridget rose. Pain radiated out in waves from Kane's crotch. With great effort, he managed to refrain from massaging his testicles, grateful that the thick, quilted padding of his thermal suit had prevented serious damage. Grant snatched the blaster away from Kata.
Hey! What if I need that?
I'll be the one to make that determination.
He gingerly probed the swelling welt on his forehead.
Goddamn Nazi prick. Can't believe somebody that old is so fast.
He can't be a real Nazi. He's some fused-out maniac who thinks he is.
He's fused out, definitely, but I think he is a real Nazi, a high-ranking one at that.
How do you figure?
An Otto Skorzeny was the creator of an elite commando force trained in foreign languages, sophisticated weapons, various forms of combat, and assassination techniques. It was Skorzeny who had the responsibility for smuggling stolen Nazi art treasures out of Germany at the end of the war. He was never convicted as a war criminal. Instead, he made himself useful to American intelligence, even though he was a fanatic Nazi who kept the faith until his alleged death in the mid-1970s.
Alleged death? If this guy is the same Skorzeny, he would be nearly 300 years old, right?
Right. And Lakesh is nearly 250.
You mean Skorzeny is a Freezy like Lakesh? Preserved here in cryostasis?
Well, that's the most likely explanation. And it's possible he's not the only one.
A nest of freeze-dried goose-steppers. Just what the world needs at this point. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Why does this shit always happen to us?
Before they left the office suite, Bridget slid open a file cabinet drawer and flipped through several sheaves of documents. The men had no complaints. They were finally warming up, and none of them was particularly anxious to pursue a deranged old German through the dark territory of the installation.
Huh.
What have you found?
Information that basically confirms my initial assessment. This place was built in 1944. The expansion of a smaller outpost established here in the late 1930s. It was overseen by Die Spinne, the Spider, Skorzeny's own little branch of the SS. It was staffed primarily by Nazi scientists, most of them brought in after the war under the auspices of Operation Paperclip.
Paperclip? Not as dramatic sounding as the Spider.
In some ways, it was worse. It was a deceitful and sinister recruitment program organized by American intelligence to keep Nazi scientists who had begun work on what became the totality concept from being tried as war criminals. They were given new identities and allowed to continue their work. This place was probably the last bastion of tried-and-true old-style Nazism left in the world before the nuke cost. The spider's web, so to speak.
Kane's lips compressed in a tight white line.
And let's find the last old-style Nazi spider and squash his ass. Come on.
Beyond an open door on the opposite side of the office was a metal spiral staircase, and they went up two complete windings before emerging onto another level. It was lit by naked bulbs in brackets bolted to the walls. Open doors led to various rooms and chambers. The four people entered a little galley with a gas stove and packed with concentrated foodstuffs, from powdered eggs to tea. Several of the shelves showed gaps, but still there appeared to be enough rations to last one man for many years. All the furnishings were in remarkably clean order. A variety of mops, buckets, and push brooms were kept in a closet. Kane couldn't help but smile at the incongruous image of Skorzeny in his SS uniform, mopping floors and polishing furniture, humming Deutschland über alles all the while. Another chamber contained a huge collection of uniforms, weapons, division patches, and medals dating back to the rise of the Third Reich. Grant examined a Mauser Kar 98K long blaster, working the bolt action.
It's cleaned and oiled.
Kane picked up a Walther P-38 pistol and squinted down its length.
So's this one.
Not surprising. Skorzeny has a lot of time on his hands to attend to this collection. I wouldn't be surprised to find out the Nazi flag we saw when we came in is the so-called Blood Banner.
What's that?
Hitler tried to take over Munich by force in 1923. A number of his followers were killed by the police, and Hitler kept the Nazi flag they carried, stained with the blood of his men who marched with him that day. Ever after, that banner was used to bless all other flags because it had been sanctified by the blood of Teutonic heroes.
That's pretty crazy.
No shit. This kind of reminds me of Strongbow's military museum.
Strongbow? That maniac you met over in England?
The very one. Lord Strongbow, ruler of the Imperium Britannia. He and old Otto would have had a lot in common.
If the room storing the memorabilia was a combination of arsenal and quartermaster's depot, the next chamber was like a museum or a miser's hoard. They saw large open crates filled with jewelry, from pearl necklaces to silver bracelets. Open chests contained the cash and coinage of many nations. Under a glass case, winking in the light, were great faceted diamonds, some of them the size of hen's eggs. Magnificent oil paintings leaned against the walls, and gold ingots were stacked in two waist-high walls, each one 4 feet long. All the bars bore bas-relief stamps depicting stylized eagles perched atop wreathed swastikas. Bridget ran a finger over the ingots.
The mystery of what happened to the Third Reich's gold reserves, solved at last.
They gaped at the pile of wealth. Kane couldn't even hazard a guess at the accumulated value of the hoard without growing dizzy.
Now we know how Die Spinne financed this place, with the loot of conquered countries and plundered museums.
Financed this place to do what? Not just as a hideout for war criminals.
The Cerberus database had this facility footnoted as something of a consultation and research center for Overproject Excalibur. Because Nazi scientists were the pioneers in eugenics, I suppose their findings and experiments were of some value to Excalibur, even if they didn't constitute an official subdivision like the Genesis Project, Project Invictus, or Scenario Joshua.
Let's see what else we can find.
Back out in the corridor, they came across a pair of bunk rooms, each one containing a dozen narrow beds. The footlockers, chained to the frames, held personal mementos and bric-a-brac. Several of them were jammed with cosmetics and women's hygiene products. A very large bathroom had 5 enclosed toilet stalls and 5 urinals, as well as a common shower area.
Unisex facilities. I guess they already had experience quartering men and women together like cattle in the death camps.
What happened to the men and women here? If they're still around, shouldn't we have come across them by now?
Bridget only shrugged. They went back into the hall and entered a huge, luxuriously furnished bedroom. It would have done credit to a medieval king. The 4-poster canopied bed was immense and could have easily held all 4 of them with room left over. An oaken, high-backed chair looked like a throne. The floor was covered by an elaborately woven Persian carpet. The walls were festooned with crossed battle axes, swords, and pikes. A full suit of knight's plate armor was mounted on a pedestal in a corner. There was even an ensuite lavatory equipped with a sunken bathtub. Like the other chambers they had visited, the huge bedroom was in perfect anal-retentive order. On a mirrored dressing table set in the center of a large lace doily was a framed, hand-tinted photograph. It depicted 2 men posing stiffly in a sparsely decorated office. The taller of the pair wore the jet-black SS uniform, his clean-shaven, aquiline head held at an arrogant angle. His eyes were steel blue. The smaller man wore a starched, pale brown uniform, very plain compared to the overdone garb of his companion. A lock of black hair curved in a comma over his forehead, and a small square mustache looked like a smudge of soot on his upper lip. The bottom of the picture bore handwritten words and a dated autograph.
Auf Wiedersehen, Otto. Adolf Hitler, April 29th, 1945. This was signed and dated the day before Hitler's death.
Look at this place. Scorsini really practiced the division between officer and enlisted men with a vengeance. A man after Baron Kobold's heart.
Leaving the bedroom, they progressed down the corridor for only a dozen yards before it was blocked by a steel-sheathed and riveted door outfitted with a complicated-looking arrangement of levers and wheel locks. A transparent observation portal was set at eye level in the dark gray mass. A printed sign beside the metal-collared frame bore large words in red and even a stylized human skull. The first word was very large, and even Kane knew what it meant. Verboten.
Baptiste, what's the rest of this say?
Biohazard beyond this point. Authorized Ananarba Institute personnel only. That pretty much cinches the primary function of this place.
What's the Ananarba Institute?
The Third Reich's version of Overproject Excalibur. It oversaw the medical experiments on concentration camp inmates and designed a breeding program for the German people. It was formed as a private scientific institution, then it was formally absorbed into the SS. The projects it was involved with earned its director, Wolfram Sievers, a hangman's noose.
The window revealed a wide, low-ceilinged room, antiseptically white in color. A maze of sterile medical equipment glittered beneath the cold light shed by overhead fluorescent tubes. The big room appeared to be broodingly silent and lifeless. Grant worked on the door. No high-tech or electronic locking systems were visible. He worked the levers and spun the wheel. The door swung inward easily on oiled pivots. Kane stepped in first, assuming the point man's position, eyes and blaster barrel sweeping back and forth. He saw three closed doors set in the far wall. He, Bridget, and Grant had visited similar laboratory setups before, so he wasn't mystified by the trestle tables bearing complicated glasswork, microscopes, fluoroscopes, and oscilloscopes. He even recognized a hyperbaric pressure chamber.
No surprises so far.
Except most of this equipment looks like it dates from the 1960s and 70s. Not like the stuff we saw in Dulsa.
Well, what were they up to with it?
Bridget pointed to a stainless steel tank in a corner. The lid was open, revealing a honeycomb pattern of individual containers that had once held frozen human embryos.
What the Ananarba Institute was always up to, trying to improve the breed.
Kane crossed the room. At the first door, he tried the knob, and it turned easily. When he opened it, a lighting system flashed on automatically. His hair lifted from the nape of his neck, and he felt his skin crawl. Although very clean and tidy, the big room beyond was a crypt. 10 complete wired-together skeletons hung from frameworks. On a long trestle table rested yellowed, grinning skulls, many of which bore deep cracks or were completely caved in. He stepped into the room, followed by his companions. Kata shuddered at the sight of all the bones. Besides the skulls on the table, trays were laid out, holding electronic components, odds and ends of small circuit boards, thread-thin antennae, and wires so small they were almost invisible. Bridget poked at them.
I guess the microprocessor and silicon chip revolution didn't reach as far as New Schwabenland.
Glancing down at a skull, Grant saw it was trephinated. Inside the hole was a sleeve socket.
What the hell were they doing with this stuff?
Bridget picked up a skull, revolving it between her hands, examining it with a critical eye.
Most of these skulls belong to an early type of Homo sapiens. Look at the supraorbital ridges.
Kane looked and saw the huge bar of brow bone and massive underslung jaw supporting chisel-like teeth.
Cavemen bones?
Earlier. Proto-humans like Australopithecus.
Kata was circling the room when he suddenly stopped dead.
Look at this!
In a little niche was a pair of vertical metal-framed vats. Within one, standing upright, was a very old corpse. It floated in a dark amber fluid. The shriveled, gnarled limbs were covered in white, shaggy hair, and its dark eye sockets seemed to stare at them. It was very tall, the sagittal crest at the top of its skull topping nearly 9 feet. Its withered facial features resembled those of an ape, but its hands and feet were more man-like than those of a simian. In the other fluid-filled vat floated small, malformed figures, distorted imitations of the corpse. The figures were not so much malformed as half-formed. They hung in the preserving fluid like so many ghastly tadpoles. Most of them resembled hairless apes, but with tiny vestigial limbs. Some of them had their intestines spreading around them from Y incisions cut in their small bodies. Bridget, Kane, and Grant had glimpsed similar horrors in the sub-level of the Dulsa installation known as Nightmare Alley, so they weren't as sickened as they might have been. Kata, however, whirled away, covering his mouth with both hands.
What the fuck is that thing? Some kind of mutie they made here?
Maybe. I don't think so. Maybe these skulls aren't fossils after all.
What else could they be?
A line of concentration appeared on Bridget's forehead. She glanced from the skull in her hands to the face of the mummy.
The Ananarba had connections with certain religious orders in Tibet, like the Bonpo. Kane, remember Gyatso?
I'm not likely to forget that creepy little bastard.
They had encountered Gyatso at the same time their paths intersected that of Grigori Zakat. Both men were fanatics. Zakat, a Russian mystic, Gyatso, a shaman of the old Bonpo religion that predated Buddhism in Tibet by nearly 1,000 years. Spiritually, Gyatso and Zakat were the same, power-mad and ruthless in their quest to harness the energies of the Chintamani stone. Their shared quest had ended in their violent, richly deserved deaths.
The Ananarba undertook an expedition to Tibet in the late 1930s, supposedly to find proof that the Aryan race had conquered it in prehistory. The Bonpo religion and Nazi occultism had a lot of things in common, so the Germans were very well treated there.
So?
Rumor has it the Ananarba was there to do a lot more than look at sacred writings and to examine artifacts. Maybe they were supplied with a yeti or a family group of them.
What's a yeti?
According to Tibetan legend, the yetis were subhuman throwbacks that haunted the Himalayas. They were known in the West as abominable snowmen. Though there were a lot of sightings of them, even supposedly a skeleton kept in a lamasery, their existence was usually dismissed as folklore.
Why would the Nazis want to experiment on Yetis?
Grant scowled at the mummy, then at the collection of electronic parts on the table. Comprehension suddenly shone in his eyes.
Mind-controlled warriors, bigger and stronger than humans.
And worse than that, perhaps. It's possible they bred human women with Yetis to create a hybrid race, forging their own path to create a new human.
Is that possible?
Who knows? If this is the corpse of a Yeti, then it appears to be a bit more human than ape. Even the chromosomal makeup of a chimpanzee is less than 1% different from a human's.
She gestured to the little bodies floating in the vat.
Those may be the failures of the undertaking, autopsied and tossed in there for further study.
If that's what the Nazis were trying to accomplish here, it's no damn wonder they weren't an official part of the totality concept.
Kata had managed to recover, so his steps were fairly steady when they moved on to the next room. It was even larger, a dispensary or sick bay. A row of hospital beds lay inside a curtained alcove. A glass-fronted cabinet contained a wide array of medical supplies, from wooden tongue depressors to pharmaceuticals to syringes. Bridget gave them a cursory inspection and took out a pair of small vials. One was half-filled with a clear liquid, and the other held white tablets.
Methadrine and amphetamines and God only knows what else. If Skorzeny is self-medicating, it would go a long way to explain his nervous agitation and speeded up reflexes.
You mean he's wired up?
To the proverbial gills. Maybe it's a form of hero worship, since Hitler was a drug addict himself.
At the opposite end of the dispensary, Kata slid back an accordion-style partition on its floor and ceiling tracks.
What's all this?
His companions joined him and saw, angled on a raised platform, two long white capsules reminiscent of oversized porcelain coffins. Recessed farther into the wall on metal shelving behind the tubes were 12 small silver canisters.
Cryo units, just like we suspected. Rip van Standartenfuhrer.
Coils of copper tubing festooned each of the small silver canisters, and the tops bore transparent convex ports. Bridget strode over to the shelves, stood on tiptoe, and peered into one.
Ah!
She recoiled. The others joined her. Looking down into the port, they saw a face looking back up at them. The head of a man was nestled inside the container, but there was only a semblance left of his features. The lips were peeled like old leather over discolored teeth. Part of the scalp was completely bare of hair and skin, showing naked bone. The little flesh remaining on his face was liquid with rot. Moving down the line, Kane saw every canister held a human head in advanced stages of decomposition.
Why the hell is Skorzeny collecting heads?
He wasn't collecting them, he was preserving them. Or at least, that was the original idea. These are cryonic storage capsules.
Just for heads?
It wasn't unknown to deep freeze heads in liquid nitrogen at a temperature of minus 196 degrees Celsius back in the 20th century. The process used to be known as neurosuspension. If these are the heads of Nazi scientists, only their brains and the knowledge within them were important enough to preserve.
Why would they go along with that?
The Third Reich wasn't known for allowing people to make their own choices. Besides, it's possible they were told their heads could be transplanted onto new bodies. It certainly looks like some form of cloning was going on here. Apparently, there was a malfunction in the units.
Apparently. So why wasn't just Skorzeny's head frozen?
Bridget stepped over to the pair of long cylinders. The exterior of both bore a small label. Trans-Time Technologies Incorporated, Los Angeles, California, patent pending.
He was probably the Guardian, his unit programmed to revive him first so he could look after the others.
Kane eyed the capsules, mentally comparing them to the suspended animation systems he had seen in other places.
It's not like the other units we've seen.
You're right. The ones we've come across before used Archon technology, stasis fields combined with cryogenics. These are strictly cryonic-based. State-of-the-art for the time, but not up to the advances later developed.
With the connection between the Archons and the Nazis, you'd think this place would have favored nation status.
It's possible Skorzeny was frozen as far back as the 1970s or 80s. When he revived, let's say 15 or so years ago, he found that the other storage units had malfunctioned. He's been trapped in here ever since, wandering around alone, probably thinking he's the last human being on Earth.
That's long enough to fuse him out permanently.
He was probably well on his way before he was frozen. Why didn't Skorzeny use the gateway to jump out of here?
Maybe it was installed after he was frozen. The fact that it's outside the facility instead of inside gives that theory some weight. He might not even know it's there. And if so, he might not know how to operate it, or he's afraid to.
I don't think that old racist is afraid of much. Who was in the other unit?
It could have been Josef Mengele himself, for all we know. Both men supposedly died at roughly the same time. But whoever it was is probably long dead.
There's nothing here for the Barons.
We don't know that for sure. There may be a nuclear stockpile somewhere in here.
Or just more memorabilia from the good old days of the Third Reich. I think we should take as much of the valuable stuff as we can haul, jump back to Cerberus, and come back with a larger team. This place doesn't represent a threat.
That might have been true until we showed up and gave Skorzeny the idea that there are other people in the world.
So?
So, if there are other people, Skorzeny may figure it's past time to go out and conquer them.
One crazy old Nazi?
One crazy old Nazi who might be sitting on rockets with atomic warheads. That's something the Barons would be interested in.
They moved out of the dispensary and through the last door. It opened onto a narrow, dimly lit passageway. Kata's nostrils flared.
What's that smell?
Kane caught a gamey whiff, redolent with the stench of excrement and a cloying odor reminiscent of a wet dog. His point man's sixth sense rang an alarm, and his finger hovered over the trigger stud of his sin-eater.